Welcome into Inside the Icebox here on the ESPN Houston YouTube channel. My name is Joe George. You find me on all social media platforms at Joe George Radio alongside Jeremy Brand. Special edition of the show this week. We did it live on the air for you during the All-Star break. We're going to talk about who is the biggest X factor for the Astros post-All-Star break. A bunch of trade deadline questions or targets, plus the debut of Bryce Matthews and an interview with Jeff Luno. We discuss all of that. And today's episode is brought to you by Blue Star Tequila, the world's first and only night harvested tequila. You can find it near you at bluestartequila.com.
But Jeremy, I want to think about the second half of the season, or the post All-Star break part of the season here, okay? Who is the number one X factor for the Houston Astros besides Yordan Alvarez the second half of the season? Who's number one on your list?
Can I say Hunter Brown?
That's fine.
Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown's last two starts before the All-Star break are kind of concerning. Do I have confidence he'll figure it out? Yeah, I do. Last year he figured out like the 19 ERA and was one of the better pitchers of all of baseball for the last 3-4 months. But his last two starts have been pretty mediocre. The velo was way down yesterday. He was in the mid-90s. Like, he was throwing 93, 94. And it's like, I don't know how I feel about that. And now he did finish that last, which I didn't want to see him in that last inning. Because a lot of times you get low velo, you kind of like lose your mechanics a little bit. It turns into like, you know, maybe it's the start of something that could cause you to miss some time. So I was clamoring for a spotter to pull him out of the game quickly. Now he did get out of that last inning, 3-up, 3-down, look good. Look probably his best inning. And he hit 96, 97 in his last two pitches. So it's like, oh, okay. He might have even been 97, 98. So it's like, oh, okay, he still has it. But I didn't love the fact that he was sitting 93, 94 for a majority of that game when he's a guy who sits 96, 97, 98. I think he's a bit fatigued. So can they get him reset, get him back on track? Because Hunter Brown has to be one of the best pitchers in baseball for the Astros to reach their ceiling. Yordan has to come back. You said accept Yordan. Pena has to be around. But like I think that if, like, even if Pena's only like 80% of who he was in the first half, I think it's good enough. Hunter Brown has to be Hunter Brown, though. That's their strength. Their strength's Fromber and Hunter Brown. And if Hunter Brown's not going to be Hunter Brown, that is a big problem.
Yeah, I've got some kind of going into like with the Yordan part of it. It's like we all just know he's a huge part of this, where if he comes back, it puts the Astros on a different track this season for what they can do, having that bat in the lineup. It means so much to this team. I think we're all under the assumption that Jeremy Pena is going to be back at some point, that this isn't a real concern with a fractured rib or broken rib, whatever you want to call it. So I think Hunter Brown's a great choice with how the last two starts went. The other pitcher that I'll include in this, because I'm going to hold Dana Brown accountable now for what he's saying, Christian Javier is a huge X factor for the Astros now going forward. I mean, Dana Brown said he's going to contribute to the team this year. What does that mean? We'll see. Will he be a starter? Will he be a bullpen arm? Like, how do you want to use him? How many pitches can he go in a game? Are all questions for sure, but he's going to impact this roster according to Dana Brown this year. And before you get to the trade deadline, you know, as we're here, we're what, 17 days away roughly from the trade deadline. If you trade for a pitcher and you have Christian Javier close to full strength, plus Hunter Brown, plus Fromber Valdez, you have an incredible rotation going into the playoffs. So I'll throw Christian Javier as my guy.
I guess I haven't allowed myself to really think about the return of Christian Javier.
I had neither until Dana Brown said he'll impact the team this year.
Dana Brown also said that about Lance McCullers and Luis Garcia last year.
I know.
He also said that, like, oh, we might get Yordan Alvarez back for the Dodger series. Oh, we might get Yordan Alvarez back this season. Oh, Jeremy Pena is only going to be gone for a week. So I've committed myself to never believe anything that Dana Brown says. Like, and until it is a factual event, I don't believe him. And it's not like that I think he's a liar. I just think that he's like, you know how people always say like they're honest to a flaw? I think that he is optimistic to a flaw. I don't think that he has any ill like feelings and like he's doing this intentionally to mislead. I think he like legitimately is super optimistic, and that super optimism fails over and over because it's too optimistic.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the timeline stuff is, and we've talked about this. You can catch Inside the Icebox every Friday morning on YouTube or the radio version at 6 o'clock. We talk all things Houston Astros. This will be the Inside the Icebox podcast this week. you look at what he said over the years and putting timelines on everything, I feel like it does make things worse. But then he also says things like what he said on the flagship this weekend, which is that Yordan Alvarez has, quote, absolutely no pain in his hand. Great information. You don't have to give us that information. I think it's more concerning, honestly. I don't like the word expedite.
No, I hate that word.
Because why? Like why are you expediting something that every step of the way has gone wrong? Like, we think about Yordan Alvarez's return, Christian Javier, Luis Garcia, Jeremy Pena, Jake Myers, all these guys who are important to your team who are hurt. I don't think you have to expedite anything. I know the first, you know, the pre-All-Star break, Astros did not look good at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean you have to expedite something, especially when it hasn't gone well at any step of the way yet.
No, I actually hate that he uses that word. And, like, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt that he's trying to use that word to, like, put fans' minds at ease. Like, hey, don't worry. Like, we're going to try hard to get him back. Like, we're going to do our, you know, college try to get him back. So I think that's his intent. I think his intent is to try to ease the burden and pain of fans. But expedite isn't how you're supposed to handle your best offensive player. You can make the case that they were expediting him earlier and, like, didn't do the proper imaging and, like, oh, that's what led to this massive setback. You can make the case that they were expediting it after they knew he had a break in the fourth metacarpal and that, you know, maybe he was doing too much hitting in the cages and, like, it was all too fast. So I actually think that they should take the opposite approach. I think they should ease him back into Major League Baseball. Hey, go take a few hacks, see how it feels the next day. Okay, go take 10 more hacks. See what it feels like the next day. Okay, let's take a little bit of live BP. Let's see what that feels like. Okay, maybe a little bit more. Okay, now a little bit of live pitching. Okay, now let's see if he can get through a rehab game. Okay, now let's see if we can go back-to-back games. Okay, now let's see if he can do three in a row. I think that they should baby him. Like, this is where I think that they struggle a lot of times, is that their goal is get back on the baseball field immediately to help the Major League Baseball team, when the goal should be more the finish line. The goal should be, how can he be the best that he can be whenever we're in the playoffs, because we anticipate to be a playoff team. It's kind of the same thing with Hunter Brown. Like, they gave him that extra start Sunday and abandoned the six-man rotation. That way he could go on normal rest and get an extra start, which I was a fan of. So this is hindsight 2020, which I hate doing that. But it's also, you have to get these guys to the end. Like, it's great to give them the most amount of starts. It's great to give them the most amount of at-bats. But is the goal to have the most of those things, or is the goal to be as fresh as they can possibly be when the games are at the most important?
I think it's the latter, for sure. I mean, you want, like, Yordan Alvarez, you want him in the lineup in October. That's all that matters. If he starts his rehab and just starts back up with the club on September 15th, that's fine. Like, will he be his best version of himself? Probably not in that situation. But at least he's on the team at that point, and he's healthy. Now, I think Dana Brown did do a good job, at least in terms of some of the verbiage he used. He did use the word could when he talked about the doctor could clear him on Thursday. Mm-hmm. That's not, you know, even though there's no pain, it also does leave him that out of, well, he hasn't been cleared yet. Like the doctor still has to go through that process. Then Yordan Alvarez has to tell us when he feels good. Then we're going to expedite his return. So there is steps there in the process, but it's huge. So I think you're right. Hunter Brown, Christian Javier, those are the guys that, to me, are so important to this team. Hunter Brown and Yordan, obviously, top two. But, I mean, again, because I have no worry about Jeremy Pena coming back this season. Where do you stack the other guys? Obviously, doesn't really sound like we're going to get much Luis Garcia this year, but what's the importance of Eric Geddy coming back?
See, that's really weird about the Garcia thing, though. Like, Luis Garcia started his rehab before Javier. So, like, whenever Dana's like, yeah, you know, we think that, you know, Christian Javier is going to be somebody who can help us a lot this year, but he doesn't mention Luis Garcia, yet Luis Garcia started his rehab before Christian Javier. So it's like, well, you would think timeline health-wise, Luis Garcia is ahead of Javier. In fact, I mean, how else could you define it? Like, one guy started his rehab before the other guy. You'd think that guy would be ahead, which I took it. The way that I took that was they must not love what they're seeing from a stuff perspective with Luis Garcia. They must be looking at his stuff and it's, you know, a shell of what it used to be. Whereas they see Javier and it's like, oh, he's hitting all of the, you know, the, the check boxes of where he should be. He's hitting 95. The movement is there. So I found that to be actually interesting too, that he was very complimentary of Christian Javier, not Luis Garcia, although Luis Garcia is about a week ahead of schedule versus Javier, at least a week ahead of Javier. He's certainly behind schedule, but a week ahead of Javier. So I found that to be interesting. I kind of read between the lines there that maybe they don't like what they're seeing from Luis Garcia, and they like what they're seeing from Christian Javier. Eric Geddes would be huge. Like, that's kind of a mystery how they've handled his injury, too. I thought that he'd be pitching in big league games by the middle of July, or at least right after the All-Star break, and he hasn't started a rehab. So that's kind of odd to me. Maybe it's their way to limit his workload, which is a fine answer. Like, I could totally respect that. I would love if they said that. But I think Eric Geddes and Javier, if they come back remotely close to what we saw from them before they got hurt, I think they could battle for the number three spot in the rotation. Like, who it is, like, I need to see what they look like first. I think both are capable of doing it. I like Brandon Walther quite a bit, too, probably more than the average bear.
You do.
I think his stuff plays. He's what a find by Dana Brown. No, I think Eric Geddes and Javier, to me, if they're back, are the two guys fighting for the number three spot. Lance McCullers, like, will he be in the mix because he has cachet? I hope not. He would have to prove us all wrong over his next however many starts before the end of the year. But no, those two guys are critical.
No, at this point, I would feel, I was going to wager on it. I would feel more comfortable wagering on Christian Javier or Spencer Eric Geddes or both of them starting playoff games over Lance McCullers.
Definitely Eric Geddes.
And that's why I said even Javier, just because I don't think Lance really belongs at this point, unfortunately, in a playoff rotation. So whether you add him now or you add to the team at the deadline or you come back just through injuries and, like, you just get this team, you know, back on track to where it was, I just feel like Lance McCullers is eventually the odd man out. And maybe next year it's different, but I think he's more what he was last year and the year before in the playoffs, and that's the man on the bench if Adolis Garcia pops off charging at him.
Yeah, it's weird to lay out what the plan could look like for Lance McCullers because he's owed a lot of money. I don't see, like, the DFA thing coming to play. And he's had some starts where you're like, oh, okay. Like, this is a big league arm. Maybe not one of your top three, top four starters. But, I mean, how do you ignore a 12-strikeout performance? How do you ignore a 6-shutout inning performance? So, like, he has the capability. He has the capability to be a big league starter. He also has the capability of being shelled and out of the game in the third inning. His margin for error is pretty wide right now. So I think that they probably keep him in a rotation. I don't see him leaving a rotation unless this lead in the American League West becomes razor thin. Like, they have a little bit of a runway to kind of, like, figure it out for a while. But once they start getting guys back and the games are more important, it makes the decision on Lance McCullers much more cutthroat.
In the highlands of Jalisco, as the fierce heat of day fades into dusk, the sun dips below the horizon, and our jimadores begin their work. Harvesting our precious agave azul beneath the glow of stars, while the night air is cool and calm. Away from the harsh heat of the sun, we protect our agave's freshness, locking in essential natural properties and sweetness, and preserving its unique flavor profile. This world-first practice has been warmly embraced by our jimadores, who relish the soothing embrace of evening's cool air as they work beneath the moonlight. 100% agave azul. Night harvested, unfiltered, and additive-free. We invite you to taste the Blue Star difference.
Jeremy, we're going to play a little game here, okay?
Yeah.
Scale of 1 to 10, how much do you like this player being acquired by the Houston Astros in a hypothetical trade?
10.
Don't pretend. Just don't worry about what's going out. Just the player coming in. That's all that matters.
Because that's all that ever matters.
That's all that really matters.
Yeah.
Joe Loperfido's traded. Everyone makes a big deal. Oh, well. All right.
Joey Loperfido came up in my mentions today.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, I said that Dana Brown doesn't seem to value contact as much as other general managers.
Okay.
Which I'm not even saying he's wrong. Like, a strikeout is an out, right? Like, what's the difference between a strikeout and a ground out? Okay, they're both an out. I've never seen somebody ground into a strikeout double play, you know. So maybe there's maybe it's more beneficial to strike out than ground out, you know. Fly out, there's advantages there because you can get a sacrifice fly. I guess a ground out, runner at third, less than two outs, you can score there too. But I'm not saying that Dana's wrong, but I do think that Dana Brown doesn't value contact as much as like the average Major League Baseball general manager based on his draft picks. And some dude was like, no, he does because he traded Joey Loperfido. I was like, how are you using one guy in a trade that they got Yusei Kikuchi back for as an example to him valuing contact?
Like, all you need is one guy to make an argument, and your argument's correct.
He's Loperfido.
That's all you need.
And he didn't even draft Loperfido.
No, he didn't.
Loperfido, he inherited Loperfido. And then he had to trade him to get Yusei Kikuchi a really good arm. It was just so weird. It was like the cherry picking of one player who he didn't draft, who was involved in a trade, the most important trade at last year's deadline, to tell me that I was wrong. It was the worst argument I've ever seen. And Loperfido was the guy involved.
Hey, you know what?
Worst argument I've ever seen.
That's good, because normally I feel like you would say that came from me, and it wasn't me.
You wouldn't have done that.
I
have more faith in you than that.
That's good.
You make outrageous takes.
No, I've been trying to be better.
Okay, so you prove my point, that you make outrageous takes, because you yourself have admitted that you do that, and now you're trying to be better about it.
Trying to be more well thought out. All right, scale of 1 to 10, how much you would like if the Astros traded for this player? I've got 7 players to go through, okay? Andrew Heaney from the Pittsburgh Pirates.
I'll give him a 7.
I think it's very kind of, you're banking on what happened with Yusei Kikuchi happening here. I think if you trade for him.
He's always been solid, Heaney. I saw him in college at Oklahoma State. Frank Anderson kid. He's not going to blow you away with stuff, but he's always going to be solid. Like, I think he's a really good number 4 starter. And I would take that right now. So yeah, I would be good with Andrew Heaney.
Zach Eflin.
0. I don't like Zach Eflin.
He's been hurt twice this year.
He's been pretty bad too.
Yeah, he's been pretty bad. I don't think that's Heaney, Kikuchi, start doing this more and it's fixed. That one to me, I would go like a 2.
I just pulled up his ERA. You want to take a gander at his ERA?
5.8.
Pretty close. 5.95.
Oh.
5.95. And like his recent games, he's not been good. Like he didn't get out. He pitched 1 inning in his last start. The start prior to that, 6 runs in 3 innings. The start prior to that, 7 runs in 5 innings. So you're telling me that you're trading, like, you better get him for free. Like, if this is the guy that you're trading for, I want him for free. I have 0 interest in Eflin.
Chris Paddock.
A little bit better stuff. Rental. He's probably closer to Heaney than Eflin. I'll go like a 5.7.
Okay. I think that's fair.
He used to be a hotshot prospect back in his early days. Like, people thought he was going to be like a Cy Young guy every year.
That's part of why I'm a little intrigued with him, is that, so that means there was stuff, like real stuff there at one point. And who fixes stuff the most? The Houston Astros.
True.
So that's why, like, if you talk to most teams, and if we were in any other city and we were talking about some of these names, people would just be going 0, 1, 2. But pitchers get such a benefit of the doubt by coming to the Astros organization that they're going to be fixed after what happened with Kikuchi and what happens with all these other guys, that I think it raises kind of the what everyone thinks the floor of the player is, besides Zach Eflin. We're out on him. Zach Gallen.
Zach Gallen, I like. He's not had a good season. Another rental. What did I give Heaney? I give Heaney a 7?
Yeah.
I'll go Gallen like a 7.3, because I think Gallen gives you like upside. Like, Gallen could be your bona fide number 3 guy reaching potential. And now your top 3 is really nasty if he reaches that potential. Mm-hmm. And even his floor not being good, he's going to give you innings. So I would be very intrigued by Gallen.
Let's go to the hitters. Cedric Mullins. We've talked about him before.
1.8. I don't like Mullins.
That's low.
I feel like...
I knew it was going to be low, but I didn't think it was going to be that low.
I feel like we look... Look, and Mullins helps you. Like, Mullins is a left-handed bat. He hits righties, like, actually not well this year. He has reverse splits this year, which came out of nowhere because he's always been a guy who hits righties well and not lefties well. Like, he helps your team. Like, he would be getting at bats instead of Cooper Hummel. Maybe you could platoon him with Chaz in center while Jake Myers is gone for 3-plus weeks minimum. So he would help you. But he also sends you into the competitive balance tax because he's making a little under $9 million. And it's like, okay, like, is he the kind of guy you want to go into the CBT for? Hasn't really hit much. I'm not big on Mullins.
Brian Reynolds. Haven't seen him connected a lot to the Astros. This is probably one of the more pricier in terms of trades. But he could play both corners, so he's your new everyday left fielder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would love this one. This would be an 8 for me.
Yeah, I'm like at a 2-4.
Really?
I think he's a slightly better version of Cedric Mullins.
Like, oh, interesting.
People look at Brian Reynolds and grade him based on who he was like 3 years ago. You look at his last 3 years, he's been spectacularly average. Like he really has. And he's not a great defender, probably a corner outfielder, probably not a center fielder. And I don't think that he has the bat that many people think that he does. Like, he was a hot trade commodity like 3 years ago before Pittsburgh extended him. And it's like, oh, this guy's the answer. And then you look at like his last three seasons, it's like, oh, this is a pretty average baseball player. And then also you have the contract. So not only do I think he's overrated, but I think he's overpaid.
What if you could flip land some colors?
Yeah, good luck.
We'll take we'll take him on. You take our bad contract.
The other thing with McCullers, too,
they would never do that to Lance.
Lance would void it. Lance has 10-5 rights. Like, this is something I thought of the other day, and like I failed to remember that Lance was a 10-5 guy because you don't really think of that rule very often. So it'd be very hard for him, I think, to sign off on any trade. There's probably some scenarios where he would sign off, but he ain't going to Pittsburgh.
No, I. No,
Brian Reynolds
you're right.
has a negative WAR. Brian Reynolds has a .287 on base percentage. He's got an OPS plus of 82. League average is 100. The dude might be the most overrated player in baseball, and it does trigger me when people bring him up because I think we do look back at who he used to be back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Like what year was it? 21. 21. He finished 11th in MVP voting, and since then he's been a little bit better than average. And then this year he's been bad, bad.
Last one. I think I'm gonna get a 9 out of you. Or a 10.
I don't know. I've been pretty harsh so far.
Well, I know you love this guy. Brandon Lowe. Lowe. Whatever.
I wouldn't go as high to a 10, but he'd be the best bat for sure. 7-5, 7-6. The con there would be that he doesn't play a very good defense. And the Astros' philosophy is pitching and defense. And like if you're trading for him, it's okay, well, he should be our second baseman. But now you're surrendering the defense that you've built your team on. So like I love the bat. He also has a club option for next year, so it wouldn't have to be a rental. You can just pick up that club option and you have him for a year and a half. So I like the idea of him a lot. I just wonder how they would deploy him. Like, do they make him the second baseman? Do you DH him until Yordan comes back, if Yordan comes back? Do you give him at-bats at first base? My guess would be that he plays second base mostly. But now you're surrendering the defense, which everybody's been... That's why I don't think it's actually realistic. Like, I like the bat in this lineup, but if you acquire the bat, he has to be your second baseman once Yordan comes back, if Yordan comes back. And then now you're kind of disrespecting your team philosophy of pitching and defense.
I have a question for you about your Twitter account. Typically, you put a slash S... For sarcasm?
Yeah, sometimes I forget.
Yeah, did you forget or were you somewhat serious about Caratini being the everyday catcher next year?
So that's not my idea. That's not my idea. Brian McTaggart wrote that in his
interesting.
Like
I missed that.
Like two newsletters ago. He mentioned, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember verbatim off the top of my head, but it was something along the lines of the Astros don't like his plate approach. They love Caratini. And it makes you like he and McTaggart alluded to the fact that it makes you think what could be the future of the Astros catcher position. So that wasn't even me. Like that wasn't my original thought. I was definitely farming engagement with that, but no, that wasn't my original thought. I do think that it's plausible, not probable, plausible that the Astros could kind of do what they did with Kyle Tucker. Not that Yonner Diaz is approaching free agency, but he might be due for arbitration, which would be a pay bump. I could see them potentially shopping Yiner Diaz and re-signing Caratini to make him the catcher. Not a good defender, Yiner. Now with the ABS, does it matter as much? Not as much, but it still matters. His pop time has gotten worse. His home to second is not very good. Doesn't throw out base runners. I know that they're concerned. Now Caratini's not great at this either. Caratini doesn't have a great pop. Caratini doesn't have a very good time home to second. But no, that was McTaggart's thought.
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting. I feel like the Yiner move would happen. Let's say it does happen. You think that's what, this offseason likely?
I toyed with the idea myself, not that I have any input, but just kind of playing general manager, fantasy general manager. I had the idea of instead of signing a first baseman this past offseason, why don't you move Yiner to first, knowing that he's not a very good defensive catcher? There's your first baseman. He's got an offseason full of training. Would he be a good defensive first baseman? No, but he's not a good defensive catcher. And I value the defense behind the dish way more than I value it at first base. Plus, it would have saved you $20 million a year. It would save you $6 million total.
And two draft picks.
and two draft picks. So, like, I would have seriously entertained the idea if I was the general manager of the Astros to move Yiner Diaz to first base in the offseason. Knowing he's not a good defensive catcher, make Caratini my full-time guy. That saves you $20 million that now you can repurpose maybe with an outfield bat, however you want to repurpose the $20 million. So I'm not sure he's a catcher going forward, at least long-term. Maybe you can get to his free agency years still as a catcher, especially with the ABS, which diminishes a little. I think it's in play, and especially because McTaggart said it. Like, if McTaggart is saying that, I take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. No one is more plugged in than Brian McTaggart when it comes to the Astros.
And it's,
so if he's bringing that up, it catches my attention.
Yeah, it's interesting. And he's only done it, so it looks like, what, 5 times this year, but Caratini can play first base.
Yes.
As well. I mean, he's played first base throughout his career. So, like, you could have gone with Yiner, Caratini, and...
You probably get me
Salazar.
He'd probably be your backup.
Just to have 3 guys on the roster.
And you can't do it anymore because you still owe Walker, you know, 40 more million, 2 more years. So,
yeah,
like,
they're not going to eat that.
That decision's done. Like, yeah. The idea of moving Yiner to first base is over. The moment you signed Christian Walker, the Yiner to first base movement was dead. But if you did do that, it would be like in the offseason, it would have been Caratini. Maybe you sign a veteran catcher to be the backup there. I don't know. Maybe that's a way you could repurpose the $20 million. And then look, Yiner would be your first baseman in that alternate reality. And you also had DeZinzo. Like, DeZinzo could have came in play there too. Or if you want to be completely revisionist history, you know how much money Paul Goldschmidt's making.
Not
He's a having
lot.
A much better year than Walker.
Yeah.
$12.5 million, which, I mean, is a decent annual average, but it's only for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So
how much of the Luno podcast did you catch with
all
Chandler Rome?
Yeah, I listened to all of it.
What did you think was the most interesting part? I think going over the blackball part where, you know, he said he's not blackballed, that 2 or 3 ownership groups have reached out to him, but he's done with baseball. I thought at the end of the podcast when he started talking about how much he enjoyed just talking baseball with Tyler and Chandler and how it kind of got his mind thinking again. I do think we're going to see Jeff Luhnow back in baseball one day.
I don't know if that we will. I believe that if somebody gave him a serious offer that he liked, he would take it though. I'll meet you halfway.
I don't follow soccer, right? So like, I don't care. Like, sorry, Glenn. I didn't realize he had 3 teams playing for championships last year, and then he just bought a 4th team.
So I think I own some stock in this little group that he has.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a very small amount. But I remember them doing like the raising funds, and then they were going to go buy these teams. So he's more ownership than GM, but like, I guess he kind of meddles a bit. But no, I guess what they do is they go in, they find underappreciated teams, markets. You know, they think they have good value. Then it looks like it's based on the sound of it. You know, they want to rebuild the franchise, and then it sounds like eventually sell them. But I thought that there was a couple of instances where it's like, okay, he would entertain something. The first one was whenever he was like, he said something like early in the podcast where he's like, you know, if I ever come back to baseball, I was like, oh, okay. So it's like, that's out there. Like, that's a thought that he has. And then at the end too, where it's like, you know, I have been reached out. I don't think that I'm blackballed. You know, I would be good at it. He said that. He goes, I know that is a fact. I would be good at it. So I wouldn't rule it completely out. I don't think he ever gets the offer that it would take for him to leave. I think it would have to be a good organization. I think it would have to be good ownership.
A lot of money.
Where I don't know if somebody like an organization like that would hire him or offer him. Like, I could see the offers for Luhnow being like, you know, mid-market teams, maybe even low-market teams, maybe that don't have great ownership. I think it would take a big offer to get him. And because of the stain of Luhnow, and not only for the sign stealing stuff, but he wasn't well liked before the sign stealing, which might have came in, you know, kind of why they were the scapegoat for the sign stealing.
I think if Luhnow comes back, there was a podcast I listened to recently about it was the biggest free agent in the NBA that no one's talking about, and it was Sam Presti becoming a free agent in 2 years, right around the time when Las Vegas and Seattle are going to become a thing, and if someone's going to leave to try to build something from the ground floor and build up, that to me also screams Jeff Luhnow as the opportunity to take over like an expansion team in Nashville or something like that, like he's doing with the soccer teams, and literally expand, build, and win with something that doesn't exist. That to me like feels like something he would be, just listening to the podcast, I was like, I feel like he could be very similar to what people think about Presti. The other one too was, you know, going over the Osuna stuff and admitting that he would like to have that one back if he could do it over again. I thought that was also very interesting in the podcast.
I think it's commendable for him to be like, hey, my bad. Mm-hmm. To be the critic than I am, though, because I am kind of critical about things. What else is he going to say?
That's true.
Is he going to double down on it? I would have done it all over again. I would have traded for this guy who had domestic abuse problems and then my assistant general manager's yelling at Allison Footer. I'm so glad we got Roberto Osuna. I don't think he had a choice but to say that.
I do think he kind of provided himself. If he wanted to, though, he had an out when he said in the podcast that he talked to his female family members before he made the deal.
Uh-huh.
So he kind of had a shield in a way to defend himself against that trade.
I don't know how that defends him, though. And he was also very defensive of the trade. He's like, he was great on the field.
No, for sure.
You know, so I think, look, it's good that he, and it's hard to know exactly the truth, right? Like, I think it's good that he apologized and was like, my bad, I would do it. I don't even know if he apologized. Where it was more like, I wouldn't have done that again. Okay, cool. That's a good look. I just don't think that he could have said anything else.
Anything else from it that stood out to you?
I mean, nothing that was new, I guess. Like the Harper thing. They had a deal done for Bryce Harper that the players were agreed on. And then the ownership with the Nationals were like, no, we're good. That would have been a lot of fun. But we already knew that. Talked a little bit about the Hader trade where he got Fires and got Gomez. He said that was the other one he would like to do again. That was a little bit because of Hader, because of how good he turned out, and then because he felt that Gomez was kind of disappointing, which he was. Gomez was very disappointing after getting him in that trade.
Yeah, I guess, in no fault to, I'm sure there was stipulations with doing this interview, to be honest.
I'm not sure that there was. I really don't, because they asked him the tough questions, I thought.
I think there was a bunch of trash can stuff missed out on.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it was everything but that.
Yeah, I would have, because the one time he did it, I know, friend of the station. It was a super softball interview.
With Glenn?
No, with Vanessa.
Oh, Luno did an interview on our station with Vanessa?
No, on TV.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, I didn't think like anything was really found out. I would have liked that in the situation, but also I get the context of it. Like, that's not what they were talking about. So I would have liked that stuff to be in there, but it was just interesting to hear him like on a regular basis like that.
I talked to him one day. I talked to him for about 10 minutes once. While he was still the GM of the Astros, they came out to watch Ian Happ. Ian Happ was at Cincinnati. They were playing at Houston. I do U of H baseball. I was doing play-by-play, and they had tons of rain. Like, so there was this long rain delay, and Luno came in the booth, and like I went up and talked to him for like 10, 15 minutes. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Like, I heard that he was kind of like, condescending and like cocky and like mean. And it was totally opposite with me. Like, it was very easy conversation. And then Elias actually went into my booth and like we talked for like an hour.
I've heard waiting out this rain. I've honestly delay. Heard really good things about Luno. Like,
I enjoyed our conversation. I mean,
when I was at the other place.
Yeah.
After the interview with Vanessa, we had gotten Jeff to agree to do an interview on the afternoon show. And the rule was we could ask anything we wanted, no holds barred, everything.
Okay.
And the Astros shut it down.
Really?
Yeah.
They didn't want Luno.
They didn't want Luno on their
station. See, that's why I don't know if, like, I feel like he's fine with those questions.
Yeah, I think so too.
Maybe not in this setting, but like, what's he going to say? Like, his defense was always like, I forwarded it to AJ. You know what I mean? So like, that's really all you can dive into it. Like, well, what, why not? Why didn't you do more? I don't know. I didn't think much of it. I just forwarded him the email. So like, I don't know how deep you can go because he's going to be like, well, I sent him the email.
Honestly, I would love to know his perspective at this point of once everything came out, like how much did you know that this was happening around baseball? Actually, I have more non-Astros questions around the cheating scandal that I feel like he might give honest answers to. Now, that would probably actually blackball him from baseball. Uh-huh. Like, what did you guys know about everyone else?
Well, I mean, I remember articles at the time where everybody was people were calling the Astros NASA. I remember watching games, and you would have catchers going to make mound visits, like in the second inning, like when they're pitching fine. It's like, okay, they think they have their signs. You had catchers back then giving multiple signs with nobody on base, like for every team. Mm-hmm. Why are you giving multiple signs with nobody on base?
Because everyone had their stuff.
Because the catcher thinks people have eyes on your sign. So if you're giving complicated, like multi-choice signs, you think the other team has your stuff. And the Astros were doing that nonstop. So they thought other teams had their stuff. Every game in baseball, the multiple signs without runners on base. And then the few times they didn't, you hear a little trash can stuff going on.
Last thing on the Astros here, Bryce Matthews came up. Yeah. Not great results. Why do you think they made that decision? Is it, was this a tryout? Was this is your second baseman until injury?
I think it's a little life in the lineup once they realize Meyer is going to be out for multiple weeks. I wish they would have done it when Pena got hurt. It would have been a little bit longer of a runway. I don't love the timing. And the part of this is hindsight 2020 because I didn't have the foresight to think about it at the time. But he only played two of the three games. Yeah, you don't want him to face Eovaldi. Eovaldi's tough on everybody, but especially on righties. But he also faced Leiter and DeGrom. Yeah, it's like, yeah, this is a reeling offense. Your team is slumping. I remember Luno would always like to call up hot prospects on the road because he felt like it was less pressure on the prospect. I feel like the timing in hindsight wasn't spectacular. You're facing three dudes who are all right-handed. The momentum on the team is bad. You're looking at him to be a spark. That's not fair to him. If they could do it over again, I wonder if they would change it. I don't know if they would, but I've allowed myself to reconsider my take on it. I wish they would have waited till after the All-Star break. Because, like, here you go, Bryce. You're gonna be brought up for 3 days. We know the pitching matchup, so we know who you're going to face. If you don't perform well, we're probably going to sit you on Sunday against Eovaldi. And then you have the entire All-Star break. So hindsight 2020, I wish they would have not called. I wish they'd have either called him up when Pena went down, or they wouldn't have called him up yet. Let him go play the futures game. Let his confidence be high. Maybe even tell him whenever they go on break. Because everybody's on break right now, not just the big leagues. The minor leagues are too. So maybe even let him know. Like, hey, we're going to call you up after the All-Star break, just so you know that. And then let him go play in the futures game. Let him get his mind right. You're on the road, maybe less pressure. Now, you are facing Seattle after the break, so like that's going to be tough pitching too. Maybe the following series or the next homestand might have been better. But I don't love the timing of it. Either do it when the Pena broke his rib or wait until after the All-Star break, maybe even a series or two after the All-Star break.
That'll do it for this episode of Inside the Icebox here on the ESPN Houston YouTube channel. We'll be back next week, same time, 9 a.m. drop on YouTube and a 6 o'clock p.m. radio show here with Joe George and Jeremy Branham. And today's episode has been brought to you by Blue Star Tequila, the world's first and only night harvested tequila. It's tequila at its natural, unfiltered best, totally additive free, and nothing is added to it and nothing is taken away. You can find Blue Star Tequila near you at bluestartequila.com. Thank you for watching this week. We'll be back next week. Peace.